We have the pleasure of speaking today to Dr. Ricardo Alvarez, Mumia Abu-Jamal's medical consultant. Can you tell us about your work and how you come to the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the imprisoned radio journalist and veteran Black Panther?
Yes, I work at a neighborhood health center here in San Francisco, and it's part of the community health center movement, which had its origins in the 60s to bring healthcare out into the community. And in my training as an undergraduate, I studied medical sociology, and I see care of political prisoners and an acknowledgement of the reality of the need of providing care to people who are in prison as an extension of our community. Since so many people in our community have loved ones in prison, and there's such a reality of mass incarceration impacting our communities.
What can you tell us about the problem of race, health, and imprisonment in the United States?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. Let me begin by saying that there's a deep appreciation that structural racism is really at the heart of what we've seen in the mass imprisonment movement. And it really is a movement. The prison industrial complex has really been created in the last 30 to 40 years that create the highest rates of imprisonment by absolute numbers and by percentage of any country in the world by far here in the United States. And if we were to ask ourselves what impact racism has, all we need to do is to refer to the seminal work of Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow. And it becomes very clear that this is specifically targeting Black and brown body people more so than it does others. However, it's also having a huge impact and impacting people who are poor.
Mumia was hospitalized on February 27th of this year. Can you tell us, from the perspective of a doctor, what precipitated his hospitalization and what's happening with him medically now?
Okay. So it's impossible to talk about incarceration and Mumia's health without acknowledging that we're talking about the health care of a political prisoner and the health care of someone for whom there is well-documented evidence that this state is trying to execute him. So that has to begin as a frame for understanding his health care, because when we examine health care, we come from a place of trusting relationship. So what we need to do is we need to begin and say and validate that not just for Mumia, but for so many Black and brown body people in this country, the distrust that they have of Western medicine is deeply validated by the historical roots of Western medicine and the racism that exists in medicine. Now, if you're going to say to me, oh, no, we don't really have that, just reflect no more than 1 week ago or 2 weeks ago when we had Stanley Livingston, who is, I mean, the name is remarkable, but Stanley Livingston, in fact, the name of someone who's one of the top editors at JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, one of the top publications in the nation. And they had a podcast in which he basically said, I don't like the term structural racism because physicians can't be racist. Well, that generated an amazing amount of petitions and responses and the recognition from the editor of JAMA that racism is a reality. That is a sea change. But let me give you one other example of how that racism plays out. We then had in the same editor interviewing Don Burrick, who was one of the titans of healthcare and involved in Medicare, and he was being interviewed about healthcare and incarceration. And he gave an open confession that racism exists in healthcare, incarcerated healthcare, and says, we know that they're neglected, and what we should do is we should impose standards of the triple aim. At no point do you have this leading figure of health saying, we need to have decarceration. So when we talk about Mumia's health, we're talking about conditions in which someone who's hospitalized has to be shackled in four-point restraints. Mumia suffers from congestive heart failure. Mumia suffers from COVID. Mumia suffers from cirrhosis, which was clearly created because he was denied direct-acting treatments earlier. This is well documented by one of the leading hepatologists in the nation, in Dr. Truskin. It's also well documented that Mumia suffered from admission to the intensive care unit some 6 years ago as a result of neglect of a high sugar hyperglycemia in a setting in which he received multiple courses of steroids, which are known to induce higher sugars. So he has suffered neglect at the hands of healthcare within the prison system. He gets recently hospitalized for this congestive heart failure. And in this hospitalization, he's left in four-point restraints, and he suffers from a severe skin condition for which he can't itch himself. And then we examine this hospitalization in the context of institutional distrust and racism and compassionate care, and we see that his case is not unique. Mumia will always let us know that his experiences are those of other prisoners. These conditions, these diagnoses, have very significant implications in terms of his prognosis and his longevity. If you'll allow me, I'm going to talk about just one of these diagnoses, which is very significant, which is congestive heart failure. People hear that term and they think, oh, well, you know, people have heart attacks all the time, they live forever. Congestive heart failure, as the name failure implies, is the point at which your pump is failing. There's objective evidence that your capacity to pump blood forward effectively is impaired. In 5 years, 50% of people die from congestive heart failure. The other thing I want to share is that there's a phenomenon
after having been diagnosed.
That's correct. That's correct. If you're diagnosed with congestive heart failure, there's a 50% mortality rate in 5 years. It's a serious diagnosis. It's not just like you had a heart attack and your heart's recuperated, because as the word failure implies, your capacity for the heart to function is impaired. Fluid backs up in the lung and the rest of the body. Yes. Now, one other thing I want to share with you is that there isn't a phenomenon that's appreciated in those who do incarceration medicine, and that's called accelerated aging. So that if you have someone who's, let's say, 50 years old, their body physiologically is the body of someone who's closer to 60 or 65. Hmm. Now, that's important because when we examine what the prognosis is and implications are, it makes sense, of course, but it's important that it's documented, this phenomenon of accelerated aging. The severe conditions of incarceration, this inhumane conditions of stresses, of overcrowding, of solitary confinement, the lack of compassionate care of people under these conditions, and the levels of violence and psychological stresses accelerates the aging. It's so well documented now what the impacts of stress are in the body. It just makes sense that those who are incarcerated would die earlier.
And we can add the horrific diet that prisoners have access to in the
prison. Correct. That's correct. That's correct. Which is why, Johanna, one of the things that I think Pam Africa articulates, and I think you as an advocate also appreciate, that the only treatment is freedom. That when we talk about these healthcare conditions, we honor what is our advocacy to help save and support Mumia, to monitor his healthcare, to make sure that he's doing well, but also to honor what is a very consistent message that we get from Mumia, is is to shed light on the conditions of imprisonment. The only treatment is freedom, where he can have a loving, supportive community and a healthy diet and some of access to different medicinals outside of Western medicine as well to help with his skin condition and to help him heal.
So let's go back to February 27th, because there was a COVID scare that eventually led to Mumia's hospitalization. Can you walk us through how Mumia ended up in the hospital and how he was diagnosed and eventually determined, the doctors determined that he had COVID? Can you just talk to us a little bit about what happened?
Yes. Well, first let me say that Mumia had had previous COVID tests that were negative. COVID tests are not 100%. And in fact, he had had a recent COVID test, and on transfer, the final test that he got came back positive. Now, that's not uncommon, because if you look at COVID testing, you'll find that it may take a couple of tests before you finally get a positive test. And in this case, the most important thing to say is that he had been developing over some months some problems around his breathing and had felt pressure in his chest. And I just want to acknowledge that I think you played a key role and Pam played a key role as being eyes and ears to his health condition and advancing the urgency of him seeking care. I had previously shared with you why people may hesitate receiving care. And I think also one of the challenges that's occurring within the prison system is that there may be a protocol where they have to wait to get an appointment. And I think with your advocacy of inviting the urgency, it became more evident that that breathing problem was also accompanied by a large amount of swelling, and that prompted the suspicion around an underlying heart condition and then a transfer to the local hospital. And it was in that transfer that they had repeated the testing for the COVID. They determined he was COVID positive, and where they had to then pull off many pounds, over 25 pounds of fluid from his body in order to bring his body back into balance.
And you're referring to Pam Africa.
That's correct. Thank you for that clarification. Pam Africa has been one of the leading supporters and of Mumia Abu-Jamal now over all these 40 years, really.
So can you give us a sense of what a body of a prisoner who has aged prematurely, as you suggested, because of all of the stresses of imprisonment, what this situation feels like in the body? He was diagnosed with COVID, congestive heart failure, approximately 25 pounds of fluid were removed from him, and he was restrained in the hospital for 4 days while he was being cared for under emergency conditions.
Right.
What does that look like and feel like for a human body?
Well, Johanna, your eloquent summary speaks for itself, because there's a certain point as a medical provider, as a physician, I just step back and say, anyone imagines that. I can't speak to what that would feel like for me to be shackled, knowing that I want to scratch my body, for me to be shackled while all of this fluid is being, the word we use is diuresed, pulled off of the body. I can't even begin to imagine. That becomes the limit of my capacity to speak to it, because for me, those are barbaric conditions of hospitalization. And this is the standard protocol. I know that we're trying to work with the UN now to address two primary issues, again relating to Mumia's condition, but the larger health issues. And one is the shackling, which is standard protocol. But also, Johanna, what we're starting to appreciate are the reports of COVID in a setting of mass incarceration. And there are some reports of patients who are COVID positive being left in gymnasiums in large numbers with few bathroom facilities in order to create the kind of isolation and separation that's needed, that the conditions of the mass incarceration and the crowding are not allowing for effective treatment of COVID. And the simple treatment is a public health measure, which is to release our elders in COVID prisons. There's good data to show that the risk to the public safety is so greatly reduced when we release our elders in prisons.
Now, I'm just thinking about what the doctors who were presiding over Mumia's care at the hospital might have thought about when they entered the room and saw their patient shackled. Can you put yourself in their shoes and give us a sense of what that means for physicians and their relationship to their patients?
Yes. There's a certain point at which a physician, I believe, has to step back and ask the question, what are the conditions of care? And I gave the example of the esteemed Dr. Berwick talking about medical incarceration and making a plea that we have high standards and check boxes to make sure that we have more efficient care and better health outcomes. But at no point are you questioning the premise of mass incarceration. That, I believe, is what we call the malignant neutrality. And we're not occupying our position as professional witness. And we saw this same kind of malignant neutrality occur in the emergence of fascism in countries where you have professional classes who don't use their professional power to speak to the truth about racism, to speak to the truth about mass incarceration, to speak to the truth around the conditions of care. At a certain point, I think it's going to be important for the physicians to work with ethical committees within hospitals and start to say, is this absolutely necessary? Can we start to establish criteria by which we say, how do we care for our patients and avoid this? That, I believe, has to happen, and it's not happening if we allow this kind of condition to occur all the time.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that Jacob Blake was shackled to a hospital bed after police shot him in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and paralyzed him from the waist down. This happened in August 2020. And police finally unshackled him after protesters exposed the gross injustice. What is clear and loud are the echoes of slavery in this horrific scene of a patient when they're most vulnerable being restrained with shackles to their bed by the state. Can you talk to us before we conclude our conversation about what doctors are doing and what are you doing alongside others to address the crisis of COVID in the prisons, but more generally the crisis of public health in the prisons?
I have to say that there are some physicians who've dedicated their careers and have done an excellent job in examining the nuances and complexities of medicine, incarceration medicine. And an example would be Dr. Bree Williams at UCSF. And her work has been instrumental in addressing COVID in prisons, and her team was the point team that was addressing the crisis that occurred in San Quentin. And they came in and they did a full-on evaluation of every aspect of care, including the circulation of air, what were the circumstances of creating conditions where patients could feel safe reporting it. And one of the things that she, I want to credit her and her team for doing, is to say, number one, decarcerate, number two, decarcerate, number three, decarcerate. So that's an exception. I don't think that there is a consciousness within the medical community about decarceration, but her work here in California that I'm most familiar with is the kind of work that's so essential. Now, for the most part, what we see is the standard narrative of Dr. Berwick, who is, again, a titan within medicine in terms of introducing the concepts of triple aim and improving quality, speaking to improving quality within the prison system. So decarceration is not yet a language. And what we're trying to do now is, again, honoring what Mumia has always shared with us, the importance of using his experience to help his brothers and sisters in prison, all of them, because Hep C is not, it affects people who are white-bodied as well as black-bodied, and there are many white-bodied families that were supporting his care when his case came to court to change the regulations. The regulations before his court case, the regulations where you practically had to die before you were eligible for Hep C direct acting medications. These are medicines that can cure Hep C. It was because of his case that they've changed those regulations. So as it relates to incarceration medicine, there is very few people within the medical field who are addressing it for a very simple reason. There's no advocacy because they're not a constituent that we really have access to. Now, having said that, let me also share that within the prison systems, there are compassionate doctors who do amazing work because they've chosen to step into those areas and make that their avocation and do the work in those hospitals. What we're not seeing is on an institutional level, the larger medical societies coming together and making a call for the release of our elders in COVID prisons. And we have to call them what they are. They are COVID prisons. And Mumia's case now is prompting us to come together and create a call to action, which includes a call to reach out to the governor in Pennsylvania, Governor Wolf, and ask for the release of our elders in COVID prisons.
Dr. Ricardo Alvarez, thank you so very much for your work and service in this struggle for justice.
Thank you, Johanna, for the amazing work you're doing in helping save the life of this beautiful spirit, this loving, beautiful spirit. And in some measures, I think that he is really the voice of the voiceless, and we speak of him as a public intellectual, and in some ways, he's a prophet in terms of giving us insight into where our nation is going. And what he says may not be things we like to hear, but it is absolutely essential that he be given the right to live to say it.
Thank you.
Thank you.